The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. You've got the H-Track all-wheel drive so you can take on those dirt trails and kick up some mud. Or the third row seating gets your whole family in to experience the thrill together. The dual wireless charging pads make sure that no one gets stuck in the great outdoors with a dead cell phone. Think about those adventurous activities you can do, like me, taking a ski trip up with the family, maybe going on a camping expedition, anything and everything. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details.
Hey there, it's Gary Parrish. It's Wednesday, January 20th, 2021. Welcome back to the CBS Sports Eye on College Basketball Podcast, where we sometimes discuss Camel Party, Dodo Birds, and Leaky Black. Matt Norlander is here with me in dead leg. We got to talk about Alabama. What in the world is happening at Alabama? The Crimson Tide, they extended their winning streak to 8 games on Tuesday with a 105-75. That's a 30-point victory at LSU. They took 43 three-pointers. They made an SEC record, 23 of them. John Petty made 8. Javon Quinterly and Josh Primo each made 6. So now Alabama, 7-0 in the SEC, in possession of a 2-game lead in the loss column of the league standings. The team started 4-3, now 12-3. Norlander, do your best to explain how Nate Oates has turned Alabama basketball into Alabama football.
That's really where this is headed, isn't it? We're seeing a morphing in progress here that is unbelievable. I think you tweeted something like that too, by the way.
I did.
This has been absolutely incredible. And what they did on Tuesday night amounts to one of the more surprising and impressive performances of the season so far. It almost felt like, you know, Alabama could almost name the score that they were going to get there. So Petty, who, by the way, give a little heads up here. I'm doing on the Thursday Court Report, I'm going to have my midseason kind of coach of the year, player of the year, top 10 nominees. And in light of what Petty did, he's going to make that top 10. I think it's legitimate at this point. There's just no doubt about it. Bama's in control of the SEC, especially after what we saw elsewhere in the league last night. And Nate Oates, he has had, I mean, it's been quite a journey over the past month or so, you know? From calling out Coach K, walking it back. Did you see what he said in advance of the LSU game earlier this week?
I did not.
He basically,
or I might have, but I don't know what
he basically
about.
Said, and I'm going to paraphrase here. He basically said, how I'm about to paraphrase it, when you listened to the quote, it was not as dismissive as this. His tone was respectful. But he was basically asked about going on the road playing an elite top 25 team like LSU and how his players would adjust, but there are no fans. And he said, listen, it's just amazing, Parrish. Nate Oates, man. He goes, listen, like, they just don't have fans in there normally. I don't know if it's really going to be all that different for our guys this year. Like, you know, it's a big building and they're a good team. But, they don't fill it up. So our guys have been playing in venues without fans. They don't have fans this year. It's not going to be that much different. I mean, it is unbelievable. And again, he was not doing this tongue in cheek. He was not doing this sarcastically. He was just kind of trying to gently but matter-of-factly say, people in LSU don't care about basketball. That building is never more than 50% full, and so it shouldn't be that much of an environment adjustment for us this season. He says all that and then goes out.
Thinking through it, I don't think I've ever been there for a game.
I haven't either. I've always been curious to go there. I've never been there for a game either, but you live close.
Yeah, so. I mean, I can get there pretty quickly. I've been there for a football game, multiple football games, but I don't think I've ever been there for a basketball game, which is odd now that I think about it.
Yeah, that is actually. You need to amend that as quickly as possible. But anyway, huge win. And yeah, Oates just continuing to be one of the best quotes. Here is one of the quotes. I just pulled it up real quick. He said, "Home court advantage is less than it used to be. LSU didn't have a very raucous crowd with us last year. My guess would be home court advantage is the same for them this year as any other year." Come on, man. Incredible. And then lo and behold, they back it up. They go in there, they romp, and Alabama's looking. I'm not saying it's a top 10 team. I'm saying it's looking and playing like a top 10 team as of late. And who knows, maybe it eventually winds up getting there.
I put them in the top 10 of the top 25 and won. I mean, you know, they still got some not great stuff on the resume, a loss to Stanford, a loss to Western Kentucky. But what do you do with a team that's just beating everybody's brains in? Because that is what they're doing right now. And they're not just beating people. They're beating people to death. The past three wins, they were 14 of 30 from three against Kentucky, 15 of 36 from three against Arkansas, 23 of 43 from three against LSU. So they've made 52 of the 109 three-pointers they've attempted in their past three games. You know, 63% of their shots at LSU were three-point attempts. And on the season, 47.3% of their field goal attempts are three-pointers, which ranks 18th nationally. Would you believe it's 18th nationally, but only third in the SEC? Trivia time.
There we go. Lay it on me. Okay, so what teams in the SEC shoot more threes per game? Three-point range.
Percentage yes. of shots yes. from three-point range. A higher percentage of shots from three-point range.
Before I answer that, would I be... I don't know if you have the entire list in front of you. Is Kentucky last on that list?
I do not have the entire list in front of me.
Definitely Arkansas is above them. Got to believe it, right?
No.
Really? That's Arkansas is not above Alabama in three-point rate.
This is not something I'd lie to you about.
Okay. Auburn for sure.
Auburn actually leads the SEC. 48.7% of its field goal attempts come from three. That ranks 10th nationally.
And then the only, I'm trying to think of what other team. I'm going to be surprised by GP because if you asked me, I would have said top three, Auburn, Bama, Arkansas, but it's not Arkansas. We know it's not Kentucky. If it's not Kentucky, Tennessee might be. Rick Barnes does not shoot threes. That team, they are, at least traditionally, that has not been the case. And it doesn't seem like it'd be Florida. Don't think it'd be Mississippi State. My blind guess is Ole Miss and Kermit.
It's not. The answer, this should not be surprising given the way this stuff works.
Okay.
You know, is basketball, football people say football is a trickle up sport. That
it
things
is.
That happen
yes.
at the collegiate level then start being implemented into the NFL.
Even high school to college to NFL, yes.
Okay. Basketball is a trickle-down sport. It goes NBA down. Things that happen in the NBA come down to college basketball. Obviously, in the NBA now, the percentage of shots from three-point range is a very important thing. So it maybe shouldn't surprise you Vandy. That the team in the SEC that does this more often than any other team besides Auburn has a coach with an NBA background.
So Vanderbilt's my first guess, given that.
That's right.
Okay. So yeah, that's, by the way, that's not working out for him right now. Vanderbilt's 4-6 is the only team that has not won a league game in the SEC so far, but that does make sense now that you lay it out.
Yeah, Auburn is attempting 48.7% of its shots from beyond the arc. Vanderbilt is 47.4, and Auburn is 47. I mean, and Alabama is 47.3. Those are the only three power conference schools who are attempting at least 47.3% of their shots from three-point range. Like I said, Alabama's been really hot this season, but on the really hot in this past three games, but on the season, they're shooting roughly 31 threes a game, making roughly 11 of them per game. They're getting 33 points per game on average from beyond the arc. And by the way, this isn't much different from last season. Last season, 49% of their shots were three-point attempts, and they made 34.9% of them instead of 35.9. The big difference, why was Alabama 16 and 15 last season, and Alabama now looking like a top 10 team this season? Last season, they couldn't guard. They were 114th in adjusted defensive efficiency. Right now, they're 11th in adjusted defensive efficiency. So they're still shooting the ball the same way, more or less, but they're guarding differently, and that is the reason Alabama has gone from okay to looking like a possible, if not probable, SEC champion.
Yep. Defense is the big key. I talked about it on HQ last weekend, and they rank better overall on defense, slightly, but better on defense than offense so far this season. Maybe a game like this brings more attention to that, or maybe it doesn't because they dropped 105 and set the SEC record for three-pointers made, though. But, yeah, riding high, man. Have not lost since 6 days before Christmas, and at 12-3, and with a talented roster. This isn't surprising in regard to, like, the talent they have. Preseason top 25 top 25 team in the eyes of some, but no one quite saw this coming. This is also the longest win streak for Alabama's program in 18 seasons. So, and they haven't won seven in a row in the SEC since the late 80s. So big time stuff here. And I love, like, Herb Jones is a wonderful, wonderful defender, and he's even been able to step up and hit some threes this year, which I think is just one of those things that expands their dynamism overall and makes them a genuinely good enough team to make a Final Four run. And it's, sometimes it's hard for us as media people or even fans when, like, Alabama making a Final Four is like Texas Tech making a Final Four. We had never seen it before, so to envision it is something that can be hard to do. But I do think that there's enough talent on this team to be able to do that this season. Quinterly has been able to adapt well. I love Jaden Shackelford's game. And then Petty is just, you know, he's hitting another level. And the fact that they are doing this, by the way, not being at full strength, I think just deserves, you know, emphasis. No Jordan Bruner in this game. He's still out for the next couple of weeks. And even without him, they look terrific. And it just so happened that their big game landed on the same night when Tennessee put up a dud against Florida. And so because of this, as we sit here and chat, it's not just that Alabama's first in the SEC. Again, it's first by two games. LSU, Tennessee, Missouri, and Kentucky all have two in the loss column. Bama has zero. And now it's projected to win the league. Not a guarantee, but with the way it's been playing, I think it's a safe bet at this point.
There's no debate about whether this is an effective way to play basketball, shooting this high of a percentage from three-pointer, this high of a percentage of your shots from three-point range. It works in the NBA. It has worked in college basketball, most notably with Villanova a few years ago. You know, that Villanova team in 2018 that won the national title, 47.5% of its shots were from three. They made 40.1% of them. They won an NCAA tournament. Here's what I would ask you. Obviously, it worked for Villanova because they made above 40% of all of these shots. At Alabama, the percentage is lower. It's 35.9%. Is this a reliable way to operate in a single elimination tournament if the goal is to actually win four games and get to the NCAA tournament? Do you have any concerns about that?
Maybe not because of this. And this could have been, to a certain extent, it could have been the opponent. Of course, you can go cold and lose. So, yes, it's not. Is it reliable?
Because, like, in a seven-game series, no. It's like, okay, we had one cold night. One cold night in the NCAA tournament, you're donezo.
Right. So LSU ranks 127 in defensive efficiency, and it just has not been it hasn't been an effective defensive program under Will Wade. In fact, Will Wade, he recruited differently from VCU. That's obviously putting it lightly. But the defensive fingerprint, if you will, of VCU under Will Wade was way different than at LSU. Bama took advantage, and LSU is just not an elite or even a very good defensive team. So against better defensive teams in the tournament, it might not be reliable. I also want to bring up one other crazy factoid stat about the game last night, and this came from Jared Burson, who is a researcher with ESPN. Hat tip to Kyle Boone, not Kyle Porter, about this, because he dropped this in our
strong
Slack.
strong jaw
Kyle Boone. So in addition to the 23 threes, Alabama scored 30 points on Tuesday night with attack drives at the rim and 6 points at the foul line. Every single point, this is, you want to talk about, you know, ultra-modern, I don't know if this was explicitly by design or if it was just basically behavior in games and practices that resulted in this. Every single point Alabama made was either a three-pointer, close to the rim, or the foul line. There was not one mid-range shot that was made by Alabama last night, and that is taking, you know, the absolute fullest extent of math, putting it on the court, and doing it. We have seen the NBA move to this aggressively in the past half decade, and now Alabama, at least in one single game, did it to maximum effect, because your best shots, if you can make them, you know, a three is worth more than two, speaks to itself. And then you're going to have a higher rate if you shoot within 5 feet of the rim than if you are 7 to 19 feet from the rim. And so you want to get your most effective shots as possible. No mid-range shots. It can sometimes make for a less creative game, but it can be a more efficient way to win, and certainly can help you guarantee. So in answering your question, if it can get close to mastering this, then yes, its chances of winning in the tournament are going to be great if it can be that good from close range and not as reliable as Tuesday night, because we shouldn't expect that. But still, trying to hit close to 40% as a team, yes, there is something there.
Yeah, now in the NBA, you're not allowed to take mid-range shots unless you're Kevin Durant. Then you can do whatever you want. But everybody else, we're at the rim or we're launching from three. To answer my own question, I think you can trust Alabama in a single elimination tournament playing this way. And the reason is because of what they are on defense. Like, if they were just an okay defensive team, then I'd be a little concerned because, you know, if you make 36% of 33s, you're probably going to be fine in most games. But if for whatever reason that goes down to 20% in a 40-minute game and you're okay defensively, you're probably losing. But they're good enough defensively to keep themselves in games. They're good enough defensively, I think, to endure a cold stretch. So I like this team. I moved them into the top 25 and won last week, jumped them up pretty high after what they did over the weekend. And now I've got them 10th in the top 25 and won after another just completely overwhelming performance. Their next game scheduled is going to be Saturday at Mississippi State. And like I wrote in the top 25 and one on Wednesday morning, they are becoming one of the big stories in college basketball for purely basketball reasons. Earlier this season, it was because of quotes from the head coach about Mike Krzyzewski. Now it's because they're bombing anybody who steps on the court with them. Duke lost 79-73 at Pitt on Tuesday. So the Blue Devils are now 5-4. Are they really going to miss the NCAA tournament? We'll get into that next. But first, check this out.
Are you looking for a new basketball shoe? If so, this is Gary Parrish here to tell you that the New Balance 2-Way V4 features the groundbreaking use of fuel cell technology with fresh foam, creating the ultimate combination of rebound and cushioning. Every step feels explosive and dynamic, and the upper construction features a lightweight textile that's supportive and breathable. So whether you're hitting the clutch shot or locking down the opposition, the 2-Way V4 gives you the tools to play at a high level. Learn more and purchase the 2-Way at newbalance.com.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
So Duke lost 79-73 at Pitt on Tuesday. The Blue Devils fell to 5-4. They're now 0-3 in quadrant one opportunities. The best win is over a Notre Dame team that's 86th at KenPom. There is not much to the resume, and they've got some questionable losses. Norlander, you concerned about Duke making the NCAA tournament?
I mean, I got to be honest. If Duke makes it or doesn't make it, I got no concern. It's not something that I'm thinking about at night. Should Duke be concerned?
What are you thinking about at night? Top three things you think about at night right now. Top three things you think about at night.
I mean, it's on a night by night basis here.
What are the three things you thought about last night?
Okay. Last night I thought about what the next song I was gonna learn on guitar. Trying to debate what that's gonna be. Sultan's a Swing, Dire Straits. Never mastered it. Kind of want to get in there. Thought about what we were gonna talk about on the pod.
Oh, I thought about that too.
Thought about that, and frankly, I thought about how glorious this day was gonna be, because as we record this podcast, you know, we're a little more than an hour away from having a new president officially. So, kind of got jacked up over that. That
was you got jacked up over.
I got jacked up over a potential return to a normal democracy. Sorry if that's weird. What about you? What'd you think about last night?
I think a lot of people were jacked up about that last night, and it carried over into today. What did I think about last night? I thought about what we're going to do with the podcast. I thought about. Here's the problem. Sometimes I can't remember what I thought about.
Yeah, exactly. This is called a cop out, by the way. So that's fine. We can steer right back into the topic here.
I thought about when I would be able to carve out a little more time to complete season 3 of Cobra Kai. I thought about that for a minute. I don't know that I reached a conclusion, but it entered my mind. I don't think so much at night.
I don't think that's true.
I try not to think too much.
I think you're thinking a lot. All right. According to Bart Torvik's T-Rankitology forecast, after the loss, he's got Duke at 15.7% chance of getting into the NCAA tournament. And it was significantly higher than that prior to the game. Still under 50%, maybe even under 40%. But we've hit that point here. You know, so we did this phase with Kentucky and we've completely moved on forever. And now we really get into it with Duke. I wasn't surprised. You and I both picked Pitt to win this game. We thought it would, and it did. And congrats to Pitt, by the way. It's 8-2 with a 4-1 record in the league. Jeff Capel is the first player ever to beat Coach K, which is obviously notable in a game. Although I'm sure he's not the first one ever. Like if they ever played 1-on-1, like you know, back in the day. But whatever. Mike Bray's the only other former assistant to beat Mike Krzyzewski. So that was a first time thing last night. And Pittsburgh is going to be a team that I think can set itself up to make the NCAA tournament. With Duke, 5-4. It's looking at its next game scheduled to be on Saturday against Louisville. That'll be an interesting one. But yeah, the wins are against Coppin State, Bellarmine, at Notre Dame, and then home to BC and Wake Forest. Not even close to good enough. If we started the tournament today, that would be weird, but Duke wouldn't be in it. If we started it tomorrow, also weird. Duke would still not be in it. It's got a lot of work to do, and we could be very well looking at a situation where Duke and Kentucky, minimally, in addition to other big schools like Arizona, we know, maybe Indiana, maybe North Carolina, could all be out of this year's NCAA tournament.
I guess I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm obviously surprised Kentucky is this bad, but I could have sort of envisioned Kentucky not living up to expectations. I'm surprised Duke is this bad. You know, they returned two rotation players, so they were at least two players ahead for the most, I don't know, whatever you think of Keon Brooks, but like at Kentucky, but like Duke returned two high-level guys. They enrolled some high-level guys. I thought Duke would at the very least be a top 25 team, and I guess they still have time to get there, but you know, they're just not good right now. Like, it wasn't even surprising that they lost at Pitt, evidence being that you and I both picked them to lose at Pitt. They've done nothing this season through nine games to suggest even for a second that they're a good basketball team. Like, at least Kentucky has had a moment here or there where you go, okay, maybe they figure some stuff out. I don't think there's even been that moment with Duke. Has Duke looked good a single game this season where you go, okay, that's what I thought we were going to see? I don't think they've even had that game.
Depends on your opinion of Notre Dame, but they did. They performed relatively well at Notre Dame, and Matthew Hurt's been decently consistent. So I think that's notable. But they have not had a signature game for a win. That definitely hasn't happened. Maybe it can come because the biggest, you know, piece of optimism for Duke on Tuesday was the fact that you had Jalen Johnson come off the bench, score 24 points, and have the best game of his college career and resemble the kind of player that they thought he was going to be more consistently throughout the season. So if that can be the case going forward, then yeah, maybe things can change. But for as good as he was, I mean, he wasn't even the best player on the floor. I mean, Justin Champagne was freaking terrific. 31 points, 14 boards. He continues to be awesome. So even in a defeat where Duke had a star performance, they still didn't even have the best player on the floor. And that's just, for Duke fans that listen to this podcast, that's just something they're not used to seeing there. And so, yes, there's a little bit of an adjustment. Only thing I'll add here is that I'm not surprised by this. In the preseason, if you told me, all right, we're going to guarantee you that at least one of Duke and Kentucky is not going to have a good season, I would have picked Duke. I just didn't think that Duke had the overall talent to warrant being a top 10 team. I begrudgingly even put him in like my top 15. I didn't even want to do that, but again, I kind of had to trust the history there. So did I see 5-4 coming? No. Did I see a season where Duke wasn't going to be like a top 3 team in the ACC coming? Yes. I didn't think it was going to be an elite team, and here it's a totally different situation altogether. And we'll wait and see if the greatest, you know, coach in college basketball history, arguably right up there with Mick Cronin, can somehow turn it around and get him to the tournament. That could still happen, but we just haven't seen evidence that it's going to happen yet.
Well, the best thing going for Duke right now is that the ACC is not that good. I mean, there's only two teams in the top 25 at KenPom from the ACC. It's Virginia and Florida State. So Duke is down relative to normal standards. Duke is down relative to expectations. Duke still might be good enough to win enough games in this league, even in its current form, to make the NCAA tournament. For whatever it's worth, KenPom has them still finishing 11-7 in the ACC, and 11-7 in the ACC probably be good enough. That'll probably get them there. But the idea that we are sitting here on January 20th, reasonably envisioning an NCAA tournament without Duke, without Kentucky, I think you can say without Michigan State, possibly without North Carolina, possibly without Indiana, those are some of the biggest brands in the sport that all could be watching the most unusual NCAA tournament in our history from a couch somewhere.
Yeah. And if we get to that point, that's obviously going to become one of the most dominant talking points in college basketball when we get to March and we've got the tournament.
Just a couple of other Tuesday night things. You've got Florida beating Tennessee pretty badly. Mm-hmm. Purdue upsetting Ohio State. Those were USC also lost to Oregon State. That's a team that wasn't ranked in the AP poll, but I did have them in the top 25 and won. So those were some other developments in the past 24 hours that are worth highlighting.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, good point on USC. So I had that. I had the quad box up on my Apple TV ESPN app, which is extremely helpful this time of the year. And I had the USC Oregon State game on, but just never had the volume up on it. So I watched it, but I never, you know, heard the commenting team, and it was on my radar, but not. But that's a stinging loss there for the Trojans, which are trying to keep pace with UCLA, and frankly now falling well behind the Bruins there, Mick Cronin, to the shock of no one on this podcast, is leading the Pac-12 and is undefeated in that league. So that's a seed bump loss for USC. There's no doubt about it. You've heard it here first. As for the two other results you mentioned, I just got to talk about them real quick, because Tennessee. First of all, I picked Florida to win the game outright, so I'm not surprised by the outcome, but I'm surprised by the margin. Absolutely. Florida is maybe one more weird loss away. Maybe it's coming this week at Georgia from being maybe the weirdest team out there. It's 7-4. It's lost to Florida State, Bama, Kentucky, and Mississippi State. Its wins are LSU, Tennessee. I don't know what to make of this team. If we asked Jerry Palm to mock up a new bracket right now, I'm guessing on the strength of that win, Florida would probably be in the field right now, maybe just in the first four. But boy, oh boy, Tennessee, what you doing? GP, I think, had you going, you know, like 26-1 this regular season. That's not going to happen. They're 4-2 in the league, and that's a problematic loss. And then, just a quick note on Purdue. Like, Ohio State, I was pretty confident was going to win that game. Nope. Purdue was 7-5, GP, on the morning of January 8th, just 12 days ago, and it was 2-3 in the league. It was staring at its next four games, three of them being on the road against Michigan State, a Michigan State team we thought was better than it is right now, an Indiana team we thought was better than it is right now, an obviously winnable game at home against Penn State, and then a really tough game against Ohio State, which Purdue already defeated earlier this year in December. If you're a Purdue fan, you're hoping to get out of that 2-2. And maybe continue to tread water. No, man. Matt Painter just continues to get it done. Just 4-0 in that stretch. Now 6-3 in the league, 11-5 overall. And whereas if you did, you know, way too early bracket projections, you know, in the first week of January, Purdue would have been definitely, you know, a bubble team riding the fence there. Now they're in. You know, they've got so much room to spare because of the qualities of these wins. And they're going to take more losses, of course. But I don't think there are many teams. In fact, there might not be more than two or three teams in the past 2 weeks that have done more to help their stock than what Purdue's been able to do by virtue of not just winning the games, but getting three road wins that'll be all logged as quad one wins. So that was a big-time gain for the Boilers there.
Yeah. One note about Purdue, I think this puts them in the minority. Once practice has started, they have not had to stop one time. They have been without interruption due to COVID issues. Obviously, another notable result, Villanova played on Tuesday night, you know, beat Seton Hall. It was Villanova's first game since December 23rd.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just thought it was interesting that as Purdue starts to go on this little run, they are one of the handful of teams from a power conference that once practice started, they've had no issues. Tip of the hat to those guys for, you know, by all accounts, living the right way and being careful. But I think you can reasonably suggest it has an impact on the season. Like other teams have to shut down practices. They have not. Other teams have had to miss games. They have not. And now they're sitting here. Yes, I agree with you, looking like an NCAA tournament team. The NCAA officially announced on Tuesday how it expects the NCAA tournament to unfold. Dead Leg, walk us through it. How is this going to work? We now got dates for the first four and everything else.
Yeah, I was pretty close on my guess there.
Close. You're bragging about being close
now?
Yeah,
of course I am. What are you talking about? Yeah, I missed one day. Yeah, I did a good job. What are you talking about? Here's what we got.
I didn't see you
getting out there and making it and guessing what the dates were. What was that about?
You want me to apologize for not guessing at something? I thought we were working in a right or wrong business.
Are you a chicken?
I think so. Okay. So, we're going to have Selection Sunday on March 14th. And then the first four, I got thoughts, okay? I got no shortage of thoughts here, okay?
Well, guess
and,
what?
And then, this podcast and then in is a throwback, perfect place for you to throwback, share your thoughts. And a throwback to GP, back in the day, this is like 7-8 years ago. You know where I'm going with this. He would file a column, and then like 3 or 4 times over like a 5-month span, he would just file another column where he wasn't done, and it would just be additional thoughts. Do you remember the additional thoughts?
I don't remember.
Come on.
I vaguely remember.
If I text Jeff Borzello right now and say, remember additional thoughts, he will instantly remember it. No doubt about it. You would file another 400-word column, and it would be, you know, I got some additional thoughts on that thing I wrote about yesterday. You don't remember?
I would do that?
100%. This was back during, you know, like the blog era, so it was just like, you know what, I'm just going to drop a little thing in there. Anyway, I got
thoughts. Sometimes I would have some additional thoughts.
You often have additional thoughts. All right, I've got thoughts and additional thoughts here. Okay, so the first four is going to be on Thursday, March 18. I talked to Dan Gavin on Tuesday night. There's a Q&A that's published at cbssports.com that you can read in the app, or you can click through on the pod description. I'll drop a link in there as well. The first four is going to be at Hinkle and Assembly Hall. Assembly Hall and Mackey Arena. And the reason for this...
Hey, you were close again.
I was close. I was close, but I was wrong. The reason I'd asked him why not Hinkle, and he said, because all of the venues in Indianapolis, we're going to have like, you know, X amount of courts in the convention center. I've told, you know, they're going to try and get 20 practice courts in there. And then Lucas Oil is going to have 2 courts. You got IUPUI's gym, Hinkle, Bankers Life. All of those venues are also going to be used for practice schedules. And so since everyone's staying in Indianapolis, it made the most logical sense to play the first four out in Bloomington and West Lafayette so that the other venues can be used for as many practices as possible, which does make sense. I tell you what, I think that this should be, and we'll have to wait and see how it all goes, but once we go back to a normal tournament schedule, first round on Thursday, Friday, I think that the first four should always be Wednesday with 4 games and just make it a day basketball game, 4 in a row. We'll see if that ever changes. I think that this will actually introduce us to because I think what's going to be good about this tournament, amongst other things, is we're going to be forced to wait. For the past 10-plus years, we've had this deal where Selection Sunday comes, we love it, and then inevitably, you're either driving home from work, if you're on the East Coast or in Central Time, you're driving home from work, or you're getting dinner ready, and you don't even realize it, but the first tournament game is technically started on True TV, and you're trying to eat dinner. Like, it just kind of sneaks up on you. This year, you're not going to have anything until Thursday, and for the youngins out there, you're going to actually feel what it's like to truly wait for the tournament to start on that Thursday, and it's kind of a... It's a good anxiety, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And so going forward, I would hope that this works and that we put all first four games on Wednesday, and then, as is going to happen this year, all those winners will feed into the first round results 2 days removed. So this year, every first four game on Thursday, the winners will play on Saturday. What do you think about that?
I'm fine with that. If you would allow me to change something with the first four, it would be that it's all at large bids and no automatic bids. That, like, if you want to, hey GP, you can mess with the first four, do whatever you like. That's what I'm doing. I'm putting the auto bids in the main bracket from the jump, and we're having the last 8 at large bids compete in Dayton to try to advance into the main bracket.
I agree with you. I asked Gavitt this very thing. This will be the one thing I give away from the piece. Here is his exact quote on why they did not do it. I said, did you even consider it in this unique year?
I can tell you why. I can tell you why.
Okay.
Because they don't care about the little schools. They just, like, they'll eliminate one of them each before they get to the main bracket.
Yep. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's also
part of it. Oh, I know he didn't say that, but that's the real answer.
He said, unless there was a very compelling reason to go away from the normal format, the committee wants to maintain as much normalcy as possible. We didn't consider that. We had bigger fish to fry. I think I can probably speak for the committee on this. It's going to be hard to do this tournament with the model that we're used to. Making change just for change's sake only creates more complications. We're trying to limit complications, right? It's a reasonable question to ask, but it's not the kind of level of detail that we've been focused on because the complexity of this enterprise endeavor is so massive that having some normalcy is something that we can embrace. I understand what Gavitt's saying there. I appreciate him taking 30 minutes to talk to me on Tuesday night for this piece to just give a little more info as to what we learned and what we still don't know and what he can't say. But simply swapping out 16 seeds for at-larges is not adding to the complexity of this whole enterprise there. It would be way better. You'd have teams from power conferences, yeah, that have been, underperforming, frustrating, but you could also have Duke or Carolina playing in the first four on Thursday and creating even more urgency there. I think it's just a misfire on behalf of the committee, and the 16 seeds should get the privilege of getting to just play in the first round as it's constituted normally there. The only argument against this is that if you're a 16 seed and you win that first four game, you do get an NCAA tournament unit, so you do receive money for your conferences, and that's why you don't see more pushback, is because every single tournament, you have at least two 16 seeds in low major leagues that are guaranteed to get their league's money because they've earned an NCAA tournament unit by way of a victory. So that's the only positive upside for it, and it's not an insignificant upside.
Yeah, let me be clear. I wasn't suggesting necessarily that they should do it this season. I understand where Dan's coming from. Like, hey, let's change the things we have to change and leave everything else alone. So I get that. I just mean in general, going forward, if you allowed me to tinker with the first four, that's what I would do. And because right now, let's be honest about the first four. It's four games, two on a Tuesday night, two on a Wednesday night, and on each night, one of them is interesting and the other one nobody cares about. You're watching two 16. You're watching two teams you've never watched before, probably, mm-hmm. if you're a casual basketball fan, play. You don't know any of the players. You probably don't know the coaches. All you know is that one of them is going to win and then 2 days later going to get probably get their brains beat in by a one seed. Nobody cares about those games. So my way is just it works on multiple levels. It allows everybody who gets an at-large bid to be in the main bracket so that you get that experience of playing Duke, playing Kentucky, playing Virginia. You know, you get a shot at something. You're guaranteed a shot at a historic moment. And even if it doesn't go well, because it likely won't, you still get that experience of day before the game, you're in the press conferences, just like Duke and Kentucky is. Mm-hmm. You're probably walking past them in a hallway. You're practicing in that arena, and then you get to go on the court in a game that everybody's going to watch. And yeah, you'll probably lose, but one day you'll be able to tell your kids, man, let me tell you about the time I played against Zion Williamson and Cam Reddish and that other guy. You know, like you get a little bit, you have that. That's worth something. So, and then I think it's awesome for the 16s, and then it creates four interesting games instead of two interesting games for the first four. The argument against it is the one that you mentioned, and I've actually had coaches of 16 seeds make this point. I'd rather do this because I'd rather go to the first four. A, because I've got a chance, I got a realistic chance to get my league a check, but B, I might can get an NCAA tournament win. Mm-hmm. Like I've had a coach of a 16 seed say, if I win that game, I am somebody who has won an NCAA tournament game. Like the details are, you know, they are what they are, but I can forever say, oh yeah, I won a game in the NCAA tournament, and that's worth something to them. And I think you're right. That's why more don't fight for it, even if I wish they would.
Yep, agreed. All right, rest of the schedule. So we're going to have the first round on Friday and Saturday, the second round on Sunday and Monday, the Sweet 16, as predicted by yours truly, will be the following Saturday and Sunday. Those will be all standalone games, which is going to be a new thing. So normally the Sweet 16 is on Thursday and Friday, and you'll have two games in overlapping windows, and you know, in the 7 o'clock window and then the 9:30 window. No, this year the Sweet 16, you're hearing me correctly, Saturday and Sunday, March 27 and 28. Every single Sweet 16 game will have its own TV window from early afternoon into the evening. I think that's going to be a wonderful bonus for this year. Then the Elite Eight will be in prime time on Monday and Tuesday, March 29, March 30th. The Final Four and championship game, as we've previously told you, remain on schedule with April 3 and April 5 there. Just a quick thought on all of the, more than just a quick thought here. randomly, I've gotten a lot of questions about this, so I'll just address this. People are wondering if like Big Ten teams are going to be able to play in Big Ten venues. The answer is yes. No, Indiana, if it's in the first four, is not going to play at Assembly Hall. It will go to Mackey. And likewise, if Purdue is a first four team, it will go and play at Assembly Hall. But Gavitt confirmed that, and like if Butler makes the Sweet 16, those games are going to be at Hinkle and Bankers Life Fieldhouse. I'll get to that in a second. But Butler would be guaranteed to play at Bankers Life if it makes the Sweet 16. But any other Big East team is going to be put in Hinkle, and if it is, it's just going to be a matter of filling the bracket out. They're not going to give any sort of special treatment. Those teams in those leagues are not familiar enough with those venues that is considered to be any kind of advantage there. So if you're wondering if Michigan is going to be able to play a first-round game at Assembly Hall because it's a Big Ten team, the answer is yes, that might happen, or it could go to Lucas Oil, but there's nothing about that is going to preclude those teams in those leagues with those affiliated venues. I've gotten that question like 15 times. So, also, as predicted, Assembly Hall and Mackey Arena, they're going to host two first four games, and then they'll each host two first round games on that Friday and Saturday. Gavitt wouldn't confirm this to me on the record, but I had another source confirm to me. Expect those games at Assembly and Mackey to be in the afternoon unless circumstances force it otherwise, because they want the teams to be back in Indianapolis at night where everyone's going to stay there. No site will ever host more than three games in one day due to cleaning protocols. I asked Gavitt if he knew basically how much time it's going to take between the end of a game and the next game to start in the same venue. He said, yes, we know that answer. No, I'm not going to tell you right now. You'll probably know it when we jointly announce our tip time template with CBS and Turner.
Why is it a secret how long it takes to clean something?
Hey, listen, man, I'm just telling you. I asked because I'm curious, but he's not giving it up. So we're going to probably find that out in February. Because I don't know if it's 60 minutes, if it's 90 minutes, if it's 2 hours, I don't know. But
I don't understand when people keep secrets that aren't worth keeping. Like the Grizzlies do this all the time. Like they'll Jaren Jackson Jr. will be injured. And it's like, okay, well, you know exactly what the injury is, obviously. You know what the timetable for a possible return is, obviously. But they will never say it. They'll just say Jaren Jackson's out until he's ready to play, but they will never, or they rarely put a timetable on it. It's like, why are you being secretive about, like a baseball pitcher has an arm injury and they say head surgery today was successful. He's expected back beginning of August. Like what is so hard about doing that? It's like my friends who work with the Grizzlies. I'm like, what secrets are you keeping today about stuff that's really not that important? And here's one, like the idea that they can't tell you how long it takes to clean a court seems unimportant, but also hilarious.
I know. I hear you, man. I hear you. But I asked, and that's the answer that I got there. So I did ask why Lucas Oil Stadium is going to host the Elite Eight and the Final Four, which we know it's not going to be filled with fans. To me, that's just a bummer, GP. Like, I thought that this was going to be the one year and the only year for the next century where we would have the national championship game played in a basketball venue. Hasn't happened since 96, Kentucky over Syracuse in New Jersey, and I thought that would happen. But I do have an answer why it didn't happen. So initially, the NCAA thought it was only going to get Bankers Life Fieldhouse, home of the Pacers, thought it was only going to get it for the first weekend for practices and then for games. And then the NCAA went back to the Pacers, and it wasn't the NBA. They went back to the Pacers and said, is there any way that you would be willing to allow us to have your building for a second straight weekend? Because what happens is the NBA hasn't released the second half of its schedule yet. And what happens is teams who own their buildings go to the NBA and say, you obviously make the schedule, but here are the dates where we have issues that we need to work around. And so the Pacers went to the NBA and said, the NCAA has asked us if we would block off basically from, March 15th until truly like March 30th to use the building. The Pacers said yes, which is no small thing, by the way. That's like a significant deal for an NBA franchise to say, we're not going to use our building for 15 days, but that's what's going to happen there. I asked them if they considered, well, why not just go first round Bankers Life because you need the venues, second weekend the Pacers can use it, and then the championship weekend you go back to Bankers Life, and it's the same amount of time that the Pacers aren't using it. Gavitt said, no, they didn't consider that. And he didn't tell me this, but we already know why they didn't consider that. They didn't consider it because they are going to, this is me guessing, I don't have this directly, but I'm using logic and I'm using the facts that are available. Lucas Oil Stadium at the end of the NFL season was allowing 10% fan capacity. Obviously, the NCAA wants to have fans in if it can. If it can safely do it, and Marion County health officials, the same people that allowed the Colts to have 10% capacity, they are expecting that those same health officials, which are working in conjunction with holding this tournament, will allow the NCAA to have at least 10% or something in that in the building. There's a huge parish. There's a huge difference between doing that in a football stadium and a basketball arena. Bankers Life Fieldhouse holds about 20,000 people. Lucas Oil Stadium has a capacity of just north of 70,000. If you up it, if the pandemic gets better, still the worst pandemic I ever seen. Okay,
the dumbest one.
I never seen one like this before. Okay, even if it gets to 15% capacity allowance, the difference in people allowed in the building that aren't, you know, media people that are, you know, players, coaches, all that, it's about 7,800 people. And when you're talking tickets, potential concessions, however they're going to do this as safely as they can do it, it's a significant difference there. And so that's why it's happening. That's exactly the reason why, because the NCAA, it's another way for the NCAA to be able to make money. I understand why they're doing it. Call me a purist, call me old school, that's fine. Do you side with me on this? I just wish they had been willing to just say, no, you know what? Because there's nothing stopping them from doing the title game in Hinkle. I understand why they can't have the Pacers building, but they could have had Hinkle if they wanted it, and they chose not to, and they're going to play it in Lucas Oil. Where do you land on this?
They're doing what they have to do to make the most money they can possibly make. They're doing what they always do. What are you talking about?
I know that, but would you have preferred it to be in a basketball venue?
Why do you think even in normal times they play these games in domes?
Oh, I understand that. Oh, yeah.
Because you could sell 65,000 tickets instead of 20,000 tickets. It's a math problem.
I know.
So, of course, they were going to take this to a dome, because even if you are restricted on how many fans you can have more in a bigger building. This is the least surprising thing of my entire lifetime.
But what would you prefer if you had the choice? What would you prefer?
I would prefer for them to play it in a basketball arena and stop tying itself so tightly to amateurism. Like, I'd change the whole thing. I'd change everything about the NCAA. But, you know, they are tied to the way they do things, and this falls completely in line with the way that they do things. They are trying to maximize the money that they can make, you know, in connection with the biggest event that they put on.
I understand.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
I know. I hear you. I hear you. I do think we can move on just a minute. I do think that this year, like that, I think that Thursday first four, it's going to be like, you know, a really good cocktail hour with amazing hors d'oeuvres at a nice wedding, and it will satiate you before you get to Friday. Because a lot, the one thing that I got a lot of blowback on, or at least a lot of people retweeted with comments when the schedule came out was, oh, this sucks, man. That Thursday's gone. Well, it's not entirely gone. Like, you're going to have the NCAA tournament starting on Thursday. There will be day basketball on Thursday. And then you're going to get that. If it means that much to you to have weekday NCAA tournament basketball, I get that. You're still going to get it on Friday. And if anything, that might be the most cherished, treasured first round weekday in history after we didn't have a tournament last year. So I still think that that Friday is going to be absolutely epic. There's more in the story at CBSSports.com. I encourage you to read it. Gavitt, he didn't give up a ton, but he gave up some stuff. I did ask him, for those that are curious about this, because I did have a few people reach out, frankly, you know, coaches amongst others, because people want to know, what's the NCAA going to do about, you know, if a team can't play in the tournament? And I'll have more about this also on Thursday in the court report. We'll talk about it on Friday. But I did ask Gavitt, hey, do you guys have a plan? Even if you can't tell me yet, like, do you have your plan in order for what you're going to do if a team gets to Indianapolis and suddenly can't play? Or if a team is an auto bid winner, fails the 7 consecutive tests COVID-wise, goes on pause, then just like teams are going on pause right now and can't get there, like, do you have confidence that you will have 68 teams compete in this tournament no matter how you get to that 68 via forfeits and substituting in? And he said, premature to answer that. That is now what they are getting to this week, next week, the week after, and they'll plan to release that in February. It's obviously a significant hurdle. They're doing everything possible they can to avoid having that happen. To the extent where, how about this? When teams travel to Indianapolis, GP, by plane or by bus, like every year the NCAA provides schools with charter planes, charter buses, so they can fly private. But when you do that, everyone has to be 6 feet apart. And I don't know how you will police this, to be honest, but it is going to be an NCAA mandate. No one is allowed to eat or drink when they are on the planes or the buses when they are leaving to go to Indianapolis. They're doing this in an effort that if someone, I think, pops positive, the contact tracing will allow potentially for the team to not be eliminated. You see what I'm saying? But it is going to be quite strict in terms of what the COVID protocols are going to be in and around the tournament. We'll get more into those details when we get into March.
All right. Before we get out of here, over the next couple of nights, because we'll talk to you again on Friday morning, a handful of interesting games, not many, handful, small hands. Indiana at Iowa, probably the most interesting thing inside Carver Hawkeye Arena. That's Thursday night, 9 o'clock Eastern. Indiana enters 8-6 overall, 3-4 in the Big Ten. They got zero wins over top 45 KenPom teams. They're 0-5 in quadrant one opportunities. The Hoosiers need a signature win. Do you give them a realistic chance to get one Thursday night at Iowa?
Define realistic.
I mean, why don't you just Google realistic?
No, define. I need parameters on this.
I'm gonna actually give you the official definition of realistic.
Give me a percentage.
Realistic is having or showing a sensible and practical idea of what can be achieved or expected.
Doesn't sound realistic to me.
It doesn't.
Sound realistic to you?
Indiana winning at Iowa is not sensible. It is not a practical idea of what can be achieved or expected. I'll tell you this. They ain't done nothing all season that would make you think it's practical or sensible to expect them to win at Iowa, but it is college basketball, so you never know.
You never know. Not expecting it. This would be maybe the biggest win of Archie Miller's Indiana career if he pulled it off, considering the circumstance of the program right now and how good Iowa is and how well Iowa has been playing as of late. Luca Garza is still the front runner, leading candidate in my eyes to win National Player of the Year. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be watching and plenty interested. That's probably the most riveting game. Riveting is overboard, actually. Intriguing, maybe even that's too much. The game that you might want to give some rubberneck treatment to, Indiana at Iowa on Thursday, I think is a good one there.
I'm actually interested in it because this is what interests me in any college basketball season. The teams that weren't supposed to be good that are great, and the teams that were supposed to be good that are struggling, especially when those teams are big brands with passionate fan bases that start hashtags like Fire Archie, because that gets tweeted at in my direction after every Indiana loss. So I'm actually genuinely interested in this because, you know, Iowa is about what we expected them to be. But Indiana was, you know, I had them preseason top 25, and they aren't bad. They aren't bad. They just don't win. They just don't beat good teams. But they're not bad. They just don't win games. I know that sounds like it contradicts each other, but I think it's actually true. They're a not bad team that for whatever reason can't win games often enough.
I hear you. That's the most intriguing one. USC at Stanford. Stanford needs that. That's a 5 o'clock tip on FS1 on Thursday. Stanford needs to get that kind of win if it wants to build an NCAA tournament resume. I don't know. The Pac-12 is definitely going to get at least four in. It's got a chance for six, but if it's going to get six, one of them is going to have to be Stanford, and you win a home game against, I say home game, they're playing in Santa Cruz. They're still not allowed to play in their own freaking county at this point. That's an important one. And then I just want to give love to a Mountain West tip here. Colorado State, Utah State, it's late on Thursday, 11 o'clock, FS1. Both those teams are teams we've talked about on CBS Sports HQ recently. Colorado State's 10-3. It just lost at Utah State on Tuesday. It's got a good opportunity here. Utah State's 12-3, yet to lose in the Mountain West, 9-0, clearly tracking toward an NCAA tournament bid. And the Mountain West, Utah State, Boise State, Colorado State, those are the three that are really competing for it. San Diego State's probably slipped a little too much there. We'll keep an eye. But give a little love to teams out in the mountain range there. Craig Smith at Utah State's certainly done a wonderful job. Nico Medved at Colorado State as well. So in addition to the Indiana-Iowa game will command the most attention. But, you know, the Rams of CSU and the Aggies of Utah State both trying to vie to get themselves in a position to have at-large consideration, and that's a big one for Colorado State.
Do you know why Carver Hawkeye Arena is named Carver Hawkeye Arena? Have you ever even thought about it?
I know that. I know the answer to that. That's Carver Hawkeye. I think he was in his teen years when Tony Hinkle was 2 years old. Carver Hawkeye was a very famous, you know, he didn't make a lot of inroads in basketball, but people don't realize, Iowa's squash team in the late 1800s, magnificent, dominant. Some might even say, you know, on the level of a dynasty. Carver Hawkeye, very famous squash coach in the late 1800s.
None of that is true. It's a weird name. Usually you get an arena named after a person, right? John Paul Jones Arena. Yeah. Or you get an arena named after, like, your, you know, Tiger Stadium. You don't really usually get a name plus the mascot. Like, if it was John Paul Jones Cavalier Arena, you don't really get that.
Well, no,
that
I mean, the Hawkeyes are named after Carver Hawkeye, right?
No, the Hawkeyes are named after Hawkeye, and then Carver is Roy J. Carver. You don't remember Roy J.?
I think Roy J. Became Carver Hawkeye again. Once he became of legal age, changed his name to Carver Hawkeye.
What if Roy J. Carver actually changed his name to Carver Hawkeye? So when you introduced him, you'd be like, "Hey, I'm Gary Parrish. It's nice to see you." He'd say, "I'm Carver Hawkeye." That's
first
a cool
of all, it's a
name.
Badass name. Okay,
Carver Hawkeye is a great name. No doubt about it. He was an industrialist, and he started the Carver Pump Factory. I learned all this last night. He donated $9.2 million just before he died in 1981. Died of a heart attack in Spain at the age of 71. And for that $9.2 million, he's had his name on that building ever since. That's pretty good value.
We're talking about him now, so you're damn right it's good value.
Unfortunately, Roy J. never got to walk inside Carver Hawkeye. It didn't open until after he was dead.
That's a damn shame.
Moment of silence for Roy J., a.k.a. Carver Hawkeye.
We miss you, man.
Been missing you. Been missing you a lot. Shouts to Devin Downey. Shouts to Chester, South Carolina. Shouts to Terry M.F. and Teagle. Legend. Shouts to Larnell. Thank you guys for listening once again to the Island College Basketball Podcast. In the middle of the worst, dumbest, most idiotic pandemic of my lifetime. I never even thought I'd see one like this. Crazy. The craziest, insane, dumbest. I never seen anything like this.
New president in 31 minutes.
I never seen one like this in Orlando. Although, hey, good news. I got my mother a vaccine appointment, got my father a vaccine appointment, got my wife a vaccine appointment all for next week. So that's good news, huh?
That's right.
That's good news.
Huge news.
That's good news. We're going to talk to you again on Friday. Till then, take care.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.